A warrior is not something you become, Dan. It is something you either are in this moment or something you are not. The way itself creates the warrior. And now you must forget me altogether. I had grown to depend so much on his counsel, on his certainty. Still trembling, I turned and walked to the door. Then I looked one last time into those shining eyes. I'll do all that you've asked, Socrates, except one. I'll never forget you. I walked down the stairs, out into the city streets, and up the winding roads through campus, into an uncertain future. I decided to move back to Los Angeles, my hometown. I took my old Valiant out of storage and spent my last weekend in Berkeley packing for my departure. Thinking of Linda, I walked to the corner phone booth and dialed the number of her new apartment. When I heard her sleepy voice, I knew what I wanted to do. "Sweetheart, I have a couple of surprises. I'm moving to L.A. Will you fly up to Oakland as soon as you can tomorrow morning? We could drive down south together. There's something we need to talk about." There was a pause at the other end. "Oh, I'd love to. I'll be on the 8 a.m. plane." A longer pause. "What do you want to talk about, Danny?" "It's something I should ask you in person, but I'll give you a hint. It's about sharing our lives, and about babies, and waking up in the mornings hugging." A longer pause ensued. "Linda?" Her voice quivered. "Dan, I can't talk now. I'll fly up early tomorrow." "I'll meet you at the gate. Bye, Linda." "Bye, Danny." Then there was a lonely buzz on the line. When I arrived at the gate the next morning, she was already standing there, bright-eyed, a beauty with dazzling red hair. She ran up to me, laughing, and threw her arms around me. "Ooh, it's so good to hold you again, Danny." I could feel the warmth of her body radiate into mine. We walked quickly to the parking lot, not finding any words at first. I drove back up to Tilden Park and turned right, climbing to Inspiration Point. I had it all planned. I asked her to sit on the fence and was about to pop the question when she threw her arms around me and said, "Yes," and began to cry. "Was it something I said?" I joked feebly. We were married in the Los Angeles Municipal Courthouse in a beautiful private ceremony. Part of me felt very happy. Another part was unaccountably depressed. I awoke in the middle of the night and gently tiptoed out to the balcony of our honeymoon suite. I cried soundlessly. Why did I feel as if I had lost something, as if I had forgotten something important? The feeling was never to leave me. We soon settled into a new apartment. I tried my hand at selling life insurance. Linda got a part-time job as a bank teller. We were comfortable and settled, but I was too busy to devote much time to my new wife. Late at night, while she was sleeping, I sat in meditation. Early in the morning, I would do a few exercises. But before long, my job responsibilities left me little time for such things. All my training and discipline began to fade. After 6 months of sales work, I had had enough. I sat down with Linda for our first good talk in many months. "Honey, how do you feel about moving back up to Northern California and looking for different work?" "If that's what you want to do, Dan, it's okay with me. Besides, it might be nice to be near my folks. They're great babysitters." "Babysitters?" "Yes. How do you feel about being a father?" "You mean a baby? You, me, a baby?" I hugged her very gently for a long time. I couldn't make any wrong moves after that. The second day up to Northern California, Linda visited her folks and I went job hunting. I learned from my ex-coach, Hal, that the men's coaching position for gymnastics was open at Stanford University. I interviewed for the job that day and drove up to my in-laws to tell Linda the news. When I arrived, they said I had received a call from the Stanford athletic director and I had been offered the coaching job to begin in September. I accepted. I'd found a career just like that. In late August, our beautiful daughter, Holly, was born. I drove all our belongings up to Menlo Park and moved us into a comfortable apartment. Linda and the baby flew up 2 weeks later. We were contented for a time, but I was soon immersed in my job, developing a strong gymnastics program at Stanford. I ran for miles through the golf course early each morning and often sat alone on the shore of Lake Lagunita. Again, my energies and attention flew in many directions, but sadly, not in Linda's. A year went by almost without noticing it. Everything was going so well. I couldn't understand my persistent feeling that I had lost something a long time ago. The sharp images of my training with Socrates, running into the hills, the strange exercises late at night, the hours of talking and listening and watching my enigmatic teacher, were fading memories. Not long after our first anniversary, Linda told me she wanted us to see a marriage counselor. It came as a complete shock, just when I felt we'd be able to relax and have more time together. The marriage counselor did help, yet a shadow had come between Linda and me. Maybe it had been there since our wedding night. She had grown quiet and private, drawing Holly with her into her own world. I came home from work each day totally spent, with too little energy left for either of them. My third year at Stanford, I applied for the position of faculty resident in one of the university residence halls so that Linda could be with other people. It soon became apparent that this move had worked only too well, especially in the arena of romance. She had formed her own social life, and I had been relieved of a burden I could not or would not fulfill. Linda and I were separated in the spring of my third year at Stanford. I delved even deeper into my work and began my inner search once again. I sat with a Zen group in the mornings in our gym. I began to study Aikido in the evenings. I read more and more, hoping to find some clues or directions or answers to my unfinished business. When I was offered a faculty position at Oberlin College, a residential liberal arts college in Ohio, it seemed like a second chance for us. But there I only pursued my personal search for happiness with more intensity. I taught more gymnastics and developed two courses, psychophysical development and Way of the Peaceful Warrior, which reflected some of the perspectives and skills I'd learned from Socrates. At the end of my first year there, I received a special grant from the college to travel and do research in my chosen field. After a troubled marriage, Linda and I separated. I set off on what I hoped would be my final search. I was to visit many places around the world, Hawaii, Japan, Okinawa, India, and elsewhere, where I encountered some extraordinary teachers in schools of yoga, martial arts, and shamanism. I had many experiences and found great wisdom, but no lasting peace. As my travels neared their conclusion, I became even more desperate, compelled toward a final confrontation with the questions that rang out in my mind. What is enlightenment? When will I find peace? Socrates had spoken of these things, but at the time I didn't have the ears to hear them. When I arrived in the fishing village of Cascais on the coast of Portugal, the last stop on my journey, the questions continued to replay themselves endlessly, burning deeper into my mind. One morning I awoke on an isolated stretch of beach where I had camped for a few days. My gaze drifted to the waterline, where the tide was devouring my painstakingly constructed castle of sand and sticks. For some reason, this reminded me of my own death and what Socrates had tried to tell me. His words and gestures played back in bits and pieces, like the twigs from my castle, now scattered and floating in the shallow surf. "Consider your fleeting years, Danny. One day you'll discover that death is not what you might imagine, but then neither is life. Either may be wondrous and filled with change, or, if you do not awaken, both may turn out to be a considerable disappointment." His laughter rang out in my memory. Then I remembered an incident in the station. I had been acting lethargic. Socrates suddenly grabbed me and shook me. "Wake up! If you knew for certain that you had a terminal illness, if you had little time left to live, you would waste precious little of it. Well, I'm telling you, Dan, you do have a terminal illness. It's called birth. You don't have more than a few years left. No one does. So be happy now, without reason, or you never will be at all." I began to feel a terrible sense of urgency, but there was nowhere to go. So I stayed, a beachcomber who never stopped combing through his own mind. Who am I? What is enlightenment? Socrates had told me long ago that even for the warrior, there is no victory over death. There is only the realization of who we all really are. As I lay in the sun, I remembered peeling away the last layer of the onion in Sock's office to see who I was. I remembered a character in a J.D. Salinger novel who, upon seeing someone drink a glass of milk, said, "It was like pouring God into God, if you know what I mean." I walked down the beach, singing the children's nursery rhyme over and over. "Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream." After one afternoon walk, I returned to my sheltered campsite, hidden behind some rocks. I reached into my pack and took out an old book I'd picked up in India. It was a ragged English translation of spiritual folk tales. Flipping through the pages, I came upon a story about enlightenment. Milarepa had searched everywhere for enlightenment, but could find no answer, until one day he saw an old man walking slowly down a mountain path, carrying a heavy sack. Immediately, Milarepa sensed that this old man knew the secret he had been desperately seeking for many years. "Old man, please tell me what you know. What is enlightenment?" The old man smiled at him for a moment, and swung the heavy burden off his shoulders and stood up straight. "Yes, yes, I see," cried Milarepa, "my everlasting gratitude. But please, one question more. What is after enlightenment?" Smiling again, the old man picked up the sack, slung it over his shoulder, steadied his burden, and continued on his way. That same night, I had a dream. I am in darkness at the foot of a great mountain, searching under every stone for a precious jewel. The valley is covered in darkness, so I cannot find the jewel. Then I look up at the shining mountain peak. If the jewel is to be found, it must be at the top. I climb and climb, beginning an arduous journey that takes many years. At last I reach my journey's end. I stand bathed in the bright light. My eyesight is clear now, yet the jewel is nowhere to be found. I look upon the valley far below, where I began the climb many years ago. Only then do I realize that the jewel had always been within me, even then, and that the light had always shined. Only my eyes had been closed. I awoke in the middle of the night under a shining moon. The air was warm and the world was silent, except for the rhythmic wash of the tides. I heard Sok's voice, but knew that it was only another memory. "Enlightenment is not an attainment, Dan. It is a realization. And when you wake up, everything changes and nothing changes. If a blind man realizes that he can see, has the world changed?" I sat and watched the moonlight sparkling on the sea and capping the distant mountains with silver. I stood, ran down the beach, and dove into the dark ocean, swimming out far beyond the surf. I knew it was time to go home. As the jumbo jet settled onto the runway at Hopkins Airport in Cleveland, I felt a growing anxiety about my marriage and my life. I felt older, but no wiser. What could I say to my wife and my daughter? Would I ever see Socrates again? And if I did, what could I bring to him? Linda and Holly were waiting for me when I got off the plane. Holly ran to me, squealing with delight, and hugged me tight. My embrace with Linda was soft and warm, but empty of real intimacy, like hugging an old friend. It was obvious that time and experience had drawn us in different directions. Linda drove us home from the airport. Holly slept contentedly on my lap. Linda had not been lonely in my absence, I learned. She had found friends and intimacies. And as it happened, soon after my return to Oberlin, I met someone very special. A student, a sweet young woman named Joyce. Her short black hair hung in bangs over a pretty face and bright smile. She was small and full of life. I felt intensely attracted to her, and we spent every available hour together, walking and talking, strolling through the arboretum grounds around the placid waters. I was able to talk with her in a way I'd never been able to speak with Linda, not because Linda couldn't understand, but because her paths and interests lay elsewhere. Joyce graduated in the spring. She wanted to stay near me, but I felt a duty to my marriage, so we sadly parted. I knew I'd never forget her, but my family had to come first. In the middle of next winter, Linda, Holly, and I moved back to Northern California. Perhaps it was my preoccupation with my work and with myself that was the final blow to our marriage, but no omen had been so sad as the continual nagging doubt and melancholy I first felt on our wedding night. That painful doubt that sense of something I should remember, something I'd left behind years ago. Only with Joyce had I felt free of it. After the divorce, Linda and Holly moved into a fine old house. I lost myself in my work, teaching gymnastics and Aikido at the Berkeley YMCA. The temptation to visit the gas station was agonizing, but I would not go until I was called. Besides, how could I go back? I had nothing at all to show for my years. I moved to Palo Alto and lived alone, as lonely as I had ever been. I thought of Joyce many times, but I knew I had no right to call her. I still had unfinished business. I began my training anew. I exercised, read, meditated, and continued driving questions deeper and deeper into my mind, like a sword. In a matter of months, I started to feel a renewed sense of well-being that I hadn't felt in years. During this time, I started writing, recording volumes of notes from my days with Socrates. I hoped my review of our time together would give me a fresh clue. Nothing had really changed, at least nothing I could see, since he had sent me away. One morning, I sat on the front steps of my small apartment, overlooking the freeway. I thought back over the past 8 years. I had begun as a fool and had almost become a warrior. Then Socrates had sent me out into the world to learn, and I'd become a fool again. So here I sat on the front steps, gazing over the city to the mountains beyond. Suddenly, my attention narrowed, and the mountains began to take on a soft glow. In that instant, I knew what I would do. I sold what few belongings I had left, strapped my pack to my back, and hitchhiked south toward Fresno, then headed east into the Sierra Nevadas. It was late summer, a good time to get lost in the mountains. Chapter 8. The Gate Opens. On a narrow road somewhere near Edison Lake, I started hiking inward to an area Socrates had once mentioned, inward and upward, toward the heart of the wilderness. I sensed that here in the mountains I would find the answer or die. In a way, I was right on both counts. I hiked up through alpine meadows between granite peaks, winding my way through thick groves of pine and spruce, up into the high lake country, where people were scarcer than the puma, deer, and small lizards that scurried under rocks as I approached. I made camp just before dusk. The next day I hiked higher, across great fields of granite at the edge of the timberline. I climbed over huge boulders, cut through canyons and ravines. In the afternoon I picked edible roots and berries, and lay down by a crystal spring. For the first time in years, it seemed, I was content. Later in the afternoon, I walked alone in the wilds, down through the shade of tangled forest, heading back to base camp. Then I prepared wood for the evening fire, ate another handful of food, and meditated beneath a towering pine tree, surrendering myself to the mountains. If they had anything to offer me, I was ready to accept it. After the sky turned black, I sat warming my hands and face over the crackling fire, when, out of the shadows, stepped Socrates. "I was in the neighborhood, so I thought I'd drop in," he said. In disbelief and delight, I hugged him and wrestled him to the ground, laughing and getting both of us thoroughly dirty. We brushed ourselves off and sat by the fire. "You look almost the same, old warrior," I said. "Not a year over 100." He did look older, but his gray speckled eyes still had their twinkle. "You, on the other hand," he grinned, looking me over, "look a lot older, and not much smarter. Tell me, did you learn anything?" I sighed, staring into the fire. "Well, I learned to make my own tea." I put a small pot of water on my makeshift grill and prepared the spicy tea, using herbs I'd found on my hike that day. I hadn't been expecting company. I handed him my cup and poured my tea into a small bowl. Finally, the words poured forth. As I spoke, the despair that I'd held off for so long finally caved in on me. "I have nothing to bring you, Socrates. I'm still lost, no closer to the gate than I was when we first met. I've failed you, and life has failed me. Life has broken my heart." He was jubilant. "Yes, your heart has been broken, Dan. Broken open to reveal the gate shining within. It's the only place you haven't looked. Open your eyes, buffoon. You're very close. I pounced on his words eagerly. Close to what?
To the end.
Fear crept up my spine for a moment. I crawled quickly into my sleeping bag, and Socrates unrolled his. My last impression that night was of my teacher's eyes shining, as if he were looking through me, through the fire, into another world. In the first direct rays of the morning sun, Socrates was already up, sitting over by a nearby stream. I joined him for a while in silence, tossing pebbles into the running water, and listening to the plop. Silent, he turned and watched me closely. That night, after a carefree day of hiking, swimming, and sunning, Socrates told me he wanted to hear about everything I could remember feeling since I had seen him. I talked for 3 days and 3 nights. I'd exhausted my store of memories. Socrates had hardly spoken the whole time, except to ask a brief question. Just after the sun had set, he motioned for me to join him by the fire. We sat very still, the old warrior and I, our legs crossed on the soft earth, high in the Sierra Nevadas.
"Socrates, you've shown me the futility of searching. But what about the way of the peaceful warrior? Isn't that a path, a search?"
He laughed with delight and shook me by my shoulders. "After all this time, you finally come up with a juicy question. But the answer is right in front of your nose. All along I have shown you the way of the peaceful warrior, not the way to the peaceful warrior. As long as you tread the way, you are a warrior. These past 8 years you have abandoned your warriorship so that you could search for it. But the way is now. It always has been."
"What do I do then, now? Where do I go from here?"
"Who cares?" he yelled gleefully. "A fool is happy when his cravings are satisfied. A warrior is happy without reason. That's what makes happiness the ultimate discipline." As we climbed into our sleeping bags once more, Sock's face shone at me in the red glow of the fire. "Dan," he said softly, "this is the final task I will ever give you, and it goes on forever. Act happy. Be happy without a reason in the world. Then you can love and do what you will." With these final words, I slept. Socrates shook me gently awake just after dawn. "We have a long hike ahead," he said. "Soon we set off into the high country." The only sign of Sock's age or susceptible heart was the slowed pace of his climb. Once again I was reminded of my teacher's vulnerability and his sacrifice. I could never again take my time with him for granted. We climbed higher and higher, mostly in silence, through sparsely wooded rocky ground, then up to the peaks above the timberline. "Socrates, where are we headed?" I asked as we sat for a brief rest. "We are going to a special mound, a holy place, the highest plateau in many miles. It was a burial site for an early American tribe so small that the history books do not record its existence. But these people lived and worked in solitude and in peace."
"How do you know this?"
"I had ancestors who lived among them. Let's move on now. We must reach the plateau before dark." At this point, I was willing to trust Socrates with anything, yet I had an unsettling feeling that I was in grave danger and that he wasn't telling me something. The sun was ominously low. Socrates increased his pace. We were breathing hard now, leaping and clambering from one huge boulder to the next, deep in shadow. Socrates disappeared into a crack between two boulders, and I followed him down a narrow tunnel formed by the huge rocks, and out again in the open. "In case you come back alone," he said, "you'll need to use this passageway. It's the only way in or out." I started to question him, but he silenced me. The light was fading from the sky when we climbed over a final rise. There below us lay a bowl-shaped depression surrounded by soaring cliffs, now covered in shadow. We headed down into the bowl, straight for a jagged peak. "Are we near the burial site yet?" I asked nervously. "We are standing on it," he said, "standing among the ghosts of an ancient people, a tribe of warriors." The wind began to buffet us, as if to add emphasis to his words. Then came the most eerie sound I'd ever heard, like a human voice moaning. "What the hell kind of wind is that?" Without responding, Socrates stepped before a black hole in the face of the cliff and said, "Let's go in." My instincts were wildly signaling danger, but Sock had already entered. Clicking my flashlight on, I left the moaning wind behind me and followed his faint light deeper into the cave.
The flickering beam of my light showed pits and crevices whose bottoms I couldn't see.
Sock, I don't like being buried this far back in the mountain. He glared at me. But to my relief, he headed back out toward the mouth of the cave. Not that it mattered. It was as dark outside as inside.
We made camp, and Socrates took a pile of small logs out of his pack.
Thought we might need these, he said.
The fire was soon crackling.
Our bodies cast bizarre, twisted shadows, dancing wildly on the cave wall in front of us as the flames consumed the logs.
Pointing to the shadows, Socrates said,
These shadows in the cave are an essential image of illusion and reality, of suffering and happiness. There is an ancient story popularized by Plato. There was once a people who lived their entire lives within a cave of illusions. After generations, they came to believe that their own shadows cast upon the walls were the substance of reality. Only the myths and religious tales spoke of a brighter possibility. Obsessed with the shadow play, the people became accustomed to and imprisoned by their dark reality. I stared at the shadows and felt the heat of the fire upon my back as Socrates continued. Throughout history, Dan, there have been blessed exceptions to the prisoners of the cave. There were those who became tired of the shadow play, who began to doubt it, who were no longer fulfilled by shadows, no matter how high they leaped. They became seekers of light. A fortunate few found a guide who prepared them, and it took them beyond all illusions into the sunlight. Captivated by his story, I watched the shadows dance against the granite walls in the yellow light. Sock continued, All the peoples of the world, Dan, are trapped within the cave of their own minds. Only those few warriors who see the light, who cut free, surrendering everything, can laugh into eternity. And so will you, my friend.
It sounds unreachable, Sock, and somehow frightening.
It is beyond searching and beyond fear. Once it happens, you will see that it is only obvious, simple, ordinary, awake, and happy. It is only reality, beyond the shadows.
We sat in a stillness broken only by the sound of crackling logs. I watched Socrates, who appeared to be waiting for something. I had an uneasy feeling, but the faint light of dawn revealing the mouth of the cave revived my spirits. But then the cave was again shrouded in darkness. Socrates stood quickly and walked to the entrance with me right behind. The air smelled of ozone as we stepped outside. I could feel the static electricity raise the hairs on the back of my neck. Then the thunderstorm struck. Socrates whirled around to face me.
There's not much time left. You must escape the cave. Eternity is not far away.
Lightning flashed. A bolt struck one of the cliffs in the distance.
Hurry, Socrates said with an urgency I had not heard before. In that moment, the feeling came to me, the feeling that had never been wrong, and it brought me the words, Beware, death is stalking.
Then Socrates spoke again, his voice ominous and strident. There's danger here. Get further back into the cave. I started to look in my pack for my flashlight, but he barked at me, Move! I retreated into the blackness and pressed against the wall. Hardly breathing, I waited for him to come get me, but he had disappeared. As I was about to call out to him, I was jarred almost unconscious as something vice-like suddenly gripped me behind my neck with crushing force and dragged me back deeper into the cave.
Socrates! I screamed. Socrates!
The grip on my neck released, but then a far more terrible pain began. My head was being crushed from behind. I screamed and screamed again. Just before my skull shattered with a maddening pressure, I heard these words, unmistakably the voice of Socrates. This is your final journey. With a horrible crack, the pain vanished. I crumpled and hit the floor of the cavern with a soft thud. Lightning flashed, and in its momentary glare, I could see Socrates standing over me, staring down. Then came the sound of thunder from another world. That's when I knew I was dying. One of my legs hung limp over the edge of a deep hole. Socrates pushed me over the precipice into the abyss, and I fell, bouncing, smashing against the rocks, falling down into the bowels of the earth, and then dropping through an opening, I was released by the mountain out into the sunlight, where my shattered body spun downward, finally landing in a heap in a wet green meadow far, far below. The body was now a broken, twisted piece of meat. Carrion birds, rodents, insects, and worms came to feed on the decomposing flesh that I had once imagined to be me. Time passed faster and faster. The days flashed by and the sky became a rapid blinking, an alternation of light and darkness, flickering faster and faster into a blur. Then the days turned to weeks, and the weeks became months. The seasons changed, and the remains of the body began to dissolve into the soil, enriching it. The frozen snows of winter preserved my bones for a moment in time, but as the seasons flashed by in ever more rapid cycles, even the bones became dust. From the nourishment of my body, flowers and trees grew and died in that meadow. Finally, even the meadow disappeared. I had become part of the carrion birds that had feasted on my flesh, part of the insects and rodents, and part of their predators in a great cycle of life and death. I became their ancestors until ultimately they too were returned to the earth. The Dan Millman who had lived long ago was gone forever, a flashing moment in time, but I remained unchanged through all the ages. I was now myself. The consciousness which observed all was all. All my separate parts would continue forever, forever changing, forever new. I realized now that the Grim Reaper, the death Dan Millman had so feared, had been his great illusion. And so his life, too, had been an illusion, a problem, nothing more than a humorous incident when consciousness had forgotten itself. While Dan had lived, he had not passed through the gate. He had not realized his true nature. He had lived in mortality and fear, alone. But I knew. If he had only known then what I know now. I found myself on the floor of the cave, smiling. I sat up against the wall, then gazed into darkness, puzzled, but without fear. My eyes began to adjust, and I saw a white-haired man sitting near me, smiling. Then, from thousands of years away, it all came back, and I felt momentarily saddened by my return to mortal form. Then I realized that it didn't matter. Nothing could possibly matter. This struck me as very funny. Everything did, and so I started to laugh. I looked at Socrates. Our eyes gleamed ecstatically. I knew that he knew what I knew. I leaped forward and hugged him. We danced around the cavern, laughing wildly at my death. Afterward, we packed and headed down the mountainside. We cut through the passageway, down through ravines and across fields of boulders toward our base camp. I didn't speak much, but I laughed often, because every time I looked around at the earth, the sky, the sun, the trees, the lakes, the streams, I remembered that it was all me. All these years, Dan Millman had grown up struggling to be a somebody. Talk about backwards. He had been a somebody, locked into a fearful mind and a mortal body. Well, I thought, now I am playing Dan Millman again, and I might as well get used to it for a few more seconds in eternity, until it too passes. But now I know that I am not only the single piece of flesh, and that secret makes all the difference. There was no way to describe the impact of this knowledge. I was simply awake. And so I awoke to reality, free of any meaning or any search. What could there possibly be to search for? All of Sock's words had come alive with my death. This was the paradox of it all, the humor of it all, and the great change. All searches, all achievements, all goals were equally enjoyable and equally unnecessary. Energy coursed through my body. I overflowed with happiness and burst with laughter. It was the laugh of an unreasonably happy man. And so we walked down, past the lakes of the high country, past the edge of the world and the timberline, and into the thick forest, heading down to the stream where we'd camped 2 days, or 1,000 years ago. I had lost all my rules, all my morals, all my fear back there in the mountains. I could no longer be controlled. What punishment could possibly threaten me? Yet, though I had no code of behavior, I felt what was balanced, what was appropriate, and what was loving. I was capable of loving action and nothing else. He had said it. What could be a greater power? I had lost my mind and fallen into my heart. The gate had finally opened, and I had tumbled through, laughing, because it too was a joke. It was a gateless gate, another illusion, another image that Socrates had woven into the fabric of my reality, as he'd promised long ago. I had finally seen what there was to see. The path would continue without end. But now it was full of light. It was turning dark by the time we reached our camp. We made a fire and ate a small meal of dried fruit and sunflower seeds, the last of my stores. Only then, as the firelight flickered against our faces, did Socrates speak. You'll lose it, you know.
Lose what?
Your vision. It is rare, only possible through an unlikely set of circumstances. But it is an experience, so you'll lose it. Maybe that's true, Socrates. But who cares? I laughed. I've also lost my mind and can't seem to find it anywhere. He raised his eyebrows in pleased surprise. Well, then, it appears that my work with you is complete. My debt is paid. Wow, I grinned. Do you mean this is graduation day for me? No, Dan. This is graduation day for me. He stood, put his pack on his shoulders, and walked off, melting into the shadows. It was time to return to the station where it had all begun. Somehow I had a feeling that Socrates was already there, waiting for me. At sunrise, I packed my knapsack and started down the mountain. The trip out of the wilderness took several days. I caught a ride into Fresno, then followed 101 up into San Jose, then back to Palo Alto. It was hard to believe that I'd only left the apartment a few weeks ago, a hopeless somebody. I unpacked and drove to Berkeley, arriving in the familiar streets at 3 in the afternoon, long before Socrates came on duty. I parked up on Piedmont and walked down through campus. School had just begun and students were busy being students. I walked down Telegraph Avenue and watched the shopkeepers playing perfect shopkeepers. Everywhere I looked, the fabric shops, the markets, the movie theaters, the massage parlors, everyone was perfectly being who they believed they were. I walked up University Avenue, then along Shattuck, passing through the streets like a happy phantom, the Buddha's ghost. I wanted to whisper in people's ears, "Wake up! Wake up! Soon the person you believe you are will die. So now wake up and be content with this knowledge. There is no need to search. Achievement leads nowhere. It makes no difference at all. So just be happy now. Love is the only reality of this world, because it is all one, you see. And the only laws are paradox, humor, and change. There is no problem, never was, and never will be. Release your struggle, let go of your mind, throw away your concerns, and relax into the world. No need to resist life. Just do your best. Open your eyes and see that you are far more than you imagine. You are the world. You are the universe. You are yourself and everyone else, too. It's all the marvelous play of God. Wake up. Regain your humor. You were already free. I wanted to say it to everyone I met, but if I had, they might have considered me deranged or even dangerous. I knew the wisdom of silence. The shops were closing. In a few hours, it would be time for Sock's shift at the station. I drove to the hills, left my car, and sat on a cliff overlooking the bay. I looked down upon the city of San Francisco in the distance, and at the Golden Gate. I could feel it all, the birds nestled in their nests in the woods of Tiburon, Marin, and Sausalito. I felt the life of the city, the lovers embracing, the criminals at work, the social volunteers giving what they could. And I knew that all of it, the goods and the bads, the highs and the lows, the sacred and the profane, were all a perfect part of the play. Everyone played their roles so well, and I was all of it, every smidgen of it. I gazed to the ends of the world and loved it all. I closed my eyes to meditate, but realized that I was always meditating now with my eyes open. After midnight, I drove into the station. The bell clanged my arrival. Out of the warmly lit office came my friend, a man who looked like a robust 50-year-old, slim, leathery, graceful. He came around to the driver's side, grinning, and said, "Fill her up?"
"Happiness is a full tank," I answered, then paused. Where had I seen or heard that saying before? What was it I needed to remember?
While Socrates pumped gas, I did the windows. Then I parked the car behind the station and entered the office for the last time. It was like a holy place for me, an unlikely temple. Tonight the room seemed electrified. Something was very definitely up, but I had no idea what.
Socrates reached into his drawer and handed me a large notebook, cracked and dried with age. In it were notes written in a careful, finely wrought hand.
"This is my journal, entries of my life since I was young. It will answer all your unasked questions. It is yours now, a gift. I've given everything I can. Now it's up to you. My work is done, but you have work still to do."
"What could possibly remain?" I said, smiling.
"You will write, and you will teach. You will live an ordinary life, learning how to remain ordinary in a troubled world to which, in a sense, you no longer belong. Remain ordinary, and you can be useful to others."
Socrates rose from his chair and aligned his mug carefully on the desk next to mine. I looked at his hand. It was shining, glowing brighter than ever before.
"I'm feeling very strange," he said in a tone of surprise. "I think I have to go."
"Is there anything I can do?" I said, thinking he had an upset stomach.
"No." Gazing into space, as if the room and I no longer existed, Socrates walked slowly to the door marked private, pushed it open, and stepped inside. I wondered if he'd be all right. I sensed that our time in the mountains had drained him, yet he was shining now as never before. As usual, Socrates didn't make sense. I sat there on the couch and watched the door, waiting for his return. I yelled through the door, "Hey, Socrates, you're glowing like a lightning bug tonight." I thought I saw a flash of light under the crack in the door.
Well, a blown light bulb might hasten his business.
"Sock, are you going to spend all evening in there? I thought warriors didn't get constipated."
5 minutes passed, then 10. I sat holding his prized journal in my hands. I called him, then called again, but I was answered by silence. Suddenly, I knew. It wasn't possible, but I knew it had happened. I leaped to my feet and ran to the door, pushing it open so hard it struck the tile wall with a metallic clang that echoed hollowly in the empty bathroom. I remembered the flash of light minutes ago. Socrates had walked glowing into the bathroom and disappeared. I stood there a long time until I heard the familiar station bell, then a honking horn. I walked outside and mechanically filled the tank, taking the money and giving change out of my own pocket. When I returned to the office, I noticed that I hadn't even put my shoes on. I began to laugh. My laughter became hysterical, then quieted. I sat back on the couch, on the old Mexican blanket now tattered, disintegrating, and looked around the room at the yellow carpet, faded with age, at the old walnut desk, and at the water cooler. I saw the two mugs, Socks and mine, still sitting on the desk, and last of all, his empty chair. Then I spoke to him. Wherever that mischievous old warrior was, I'd have the last word.
"Well, Sock, here I am, between past and future again, floating between heaven and earth. What can I say to you that would be enough? Thank you, my teacher, my inspiration, my friend. I'll miss you." I left the station for the last time feeling only wonder. I knew that I'd not lost him, not really. It had taken me all these years to see the obvious, that Socrates and I had never been different. All this time, we had been one and the same. I walked through the tree-lined paths of campus, across the creek, and beyond the shady groves out into the city, continuing on the way of the peaceful warrior, the way toward home. Epilogue. Laughter in the wind. I'd passed through the gate, seen what there was to see, realized high on a mountain my true nature. Yet, like the old man who shouldered his burden and continued on his way, I knew that though everything had changed, nothing had changed. I was still living an ordinary human life with ordinary human responsibilities. I would have to adapt myself to living a happy, useful life in a world which was offended by one who was no longer interested in any search or problem. An unreasonably happy person, I learned, can grate on people's nerves. There were many occasions when I began to understand and even envy the monks who set up housekeeping in faraway caves. But I had been to my cave. My time for receiving was finished. Now it was time for giving. I moved from Palo Alto to San Francisco and began work as a house painter. As soon as I was settled into a house, I attended to some unfinished business. I hadn't spoken with Joyce since Oberlin. I found her number in New Jersey and called her.
"Dan, what a surprise! How are you?"
"Very well, Joyce. I've been through a lot recently." There was a pause on the line.
How is your daughter? And your wife?"
"Linda and Holly are doing fine. Linda and I were divorced some time ago."
"Dan,"
there was another pause, "why did you call?" I took a deep breath. "Joyce, I want you to come to California and live with me. I have no doubts at all about you, about us. There's plenty of room here."
"Dan," Joyce laughed, "you're going much too fast for me. When do you propose this little adjustment should take place?"
"Now, or as soon as you can. Joyce, there's so much to tell you, things I've never told anyone. I've held in for so long. Will you call me as soon as you've decided?"
"Dan, are you sure of this?"
"Yes, believe me, and I'll be waiting here every evening for your call." About 2 weeks later, I received a call at 7:15 p.m.
"Joyce, I'm calling from the airport."
"From Newark Airport? You're leaving? You're coming?"
"From San Francisco Airport. I've arrived."
For a moment, I didn't get it.
"San Francisco Airport?"
"Yes," she laughed. "You know that landing strip south of the city? Well, are you going to meet me, or shall I hitchhike?" In the days that followed, we spent every free moment together. I'd quit my painting job and was teaching in a small gymnastics studio in San Francisco. I told her about my life, much as it is written here, and all about Socrates. She listened intently.
"You know, Dan, I get a funny feeling when you tell me about that man, as if I know him."
"Well, anything's possible," I said, smiling.
"No, really, like I knew him. What I never told you before, Danny, is that I left home just before starting high school."
"Well," I responded, "that's unusual, but not too strange."
"The strange part is that the years between my leaving home and coming to Oberlin are a complete blank in my memory. And that's not all. At Oberlin, before you came, I remember having dreams, very strange dreams, about someone like you, and about a white-haired man, and my parents, Danny." Her large, luminous eyes opened wide and filled with tears. "My parents always called me by my nickname." I held her shoulders and looked into her eyes. In the next moment, like an electric shock, a place in our memories opened up as she said, "My nickname was Joy." We were married among our friends in the mountains of California. It was a moment I would have given anything to share with a man who had begun it all for both of us. Then I remembered the card he had given me, the one I was to use if I ever really needed him. I figured now was the time. I slipped away for a moment and walked across the road to a small mound of earth overlooking the woods and rolling hills. There was a garden there with a single elm tree, almost hidden among the grape arbors. I reached into my wallet and found the card there among my other papers. It was dog-eared, but still glowing. "Warrior Incorporated, Socrates Proprietor, specializing in paradox, humor, and change. Emergencies only." I held it in both hands and spoke softly. "All right, Socrates, you old wizard, do your stuff. Come visit us, Soc." I waited and tried again. Nothing happened, nothing at all, only a gust of wind. My disappointment surprised me. I had held to a secret hope that he might somehow return, but he wasn't coming, not now, not ever.
My hands dropped to my sides, and I looked down at the earth. Goodbye, Socrates. Goodbye, my friend. I opened my wallet to slip the card back in, glancing again at its lingering glow. The card had changed. In place of emergencies only was a single word, glowing brighter than the rest. It said, happiness. His wedding gift. In that moment, a warm breeze caressed my face, mussed my hair, and a falling leaf slapped my cheek as it floated down from the elm. I threw my head back, laughing with delight, and looked up through the elm's outstretched branches into the clouds drifting lazily by. I gazed above the stone fence, out over the houses dotted in the green forest below. The wind gusted again, and a lone bird soared by. Then I felt the truth of it. Socrates hadn't come because he had never left. He was only changed. He was the elm above my head. He was the clouds and the bird and the wind. They would always be my teachers, my friends. Before walking back to my wife, my home, my friends, and my future, I surveyed the world around me. Socrates was here. He was everywhere.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.